public hearing on the review of the National Gambling Legislation, whereby we expect the members of the public, the people who are involved in the industry, to come and tell us as the control committee what is it which we can do to make this legislation better so that it can work for everyone. We know that there are people who are pro it, there are people who are against it. But at the end of the day, as a government, we serve everyone. That's why it is of paramount importance that we take everyone's views on board. And then eventually, then after that process, then we'll have to come with a new bill on which we are going to revise this legislation. But as I said, that we are moving on a slippery slope here. As I said, that there are people who are for the gambling, there are people who are against that. So I think that what we'll do, we'll just have a few rules which we have to observe here. Because we have a lot of opposing opinions. The first rule which we are going to observe in this meeting, and that's going to apply to everyone, the first rule, one, is that the chairperson is always right. Whatever you do, the chairperson is always right. Rule number two, if you are unsure of anything, if you need clarity on anything, you must always go to the first rule. The chairperson is always right, and then everything will go right. So without a waste of time, I'll request everyone, the people who are inside here, to introduce themselves. Today we are going to have, in the first session, we are going to have three presentations. Those three presentations will be coming from two slots. And number two will have AJ Consulting. Where are these people? AJ Consulting. Number three will be having Pumelela Gaming. So we'll start first with the two slots. The people who will represent two slots, will you please introduce yourself, and then so that you'll be able to move forward. Without further ado, I'll start first by introducing the portfolio committee. I'll start on my left hand side. Because I'm a left winger, you know, so I'll start on the left.
My name is Kobus Marie, I'm a member of this committee.
Andrikus van der Westhuizen, also a member of the portfolio committee.
Shitlango Mabasa, a member of the committee.
Sigile Khumalo, the member of the committee.
Ndaba Tswabaza, member of the committee.
Stephen Jigelana, member of the committee.
All right, thank you, members. I'm Peggy Khatebe, the whip of the committee. As I said, that I'm standing in for the chairman for the time being. So can someone from two slots who's going to present introduce herself and the delegation she's moving with, or if she's alone, it's fine.
Thank you, Sue. Good morning. My name is Giselle Parton. I'm the corporate affairs manager for a company called 2A Gaming South Africa. And with two colleagues of mine, Sir Duncan Pollock on my left and Kieran Rama on my right. Giselle Parton from 2A Gaming South Africa. I'm the corporate affairs manager. My two colleagues behind me, Kieran Rama and Duncan Pollock.
Thank you. All right, I think that this seat has been too hot for me. The owner has just come in. So the chairperson of the committee has just arrived. She's Ms. Pap. She's the one who's going to take us through.
My apologies to everyone. I've gone back to Harting because my brother-in-law had passed away, and so of course I could only get on the 6 a.m. flight and have arrived now. But I would like to thank the whip of the committee, the Honourable Khadebe, for already opening and not delaying things unduly. So do press ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My presentation will cover briefly an introduction to the 2A Gaming Group, a legislative history of the limited payout machine industry, an overview of the industry as it exists today, and then we will highlight some of the problems which we experience with the regulatory process and make some proposals in order to address those problems. Tura Gaming South Africa is the holding company for two subsidiaries which operate as REACH operators. The one company, Tura Gaming Western Cape, operates 1,000 limited payout machines in the Western Cape. It was licensed on the 1st of June 2005 by the Western Cape Gambling and Racing Board. The other company, Tura Gaming KwaZulu Natal, is also licensed to operate 1,000 limited payout machines. It was licensed by the KwaZulu Natal Gambling Board on the 1st of July 2006. The limited payout machine industry is, although it's a fairly new industry in terms of its rollout, the legislative and policy framework for the industry was mooted as far back as 1995. It was adopted in various provincial regulations starting in August 1996 with the Mpumalanga gambling regulations, followed by the Gauteng gambling regulations in February 97, the KwaZulu-Natal regulations in February 98. In Western Cape, they came to operation also in 97, likewise in Limpopo, and in the Eastern Cape also in 1998. So it's the legislation has been in place for a considerable period of time, although the industry has only started rolling out recently. Some of the key elements that the limited payout machine industry needs to operate in terms of, well, let me go back and say, the limited payout machine industry is restricted by law. And the reason that it is restricted was it was a reaction to all the illegal slot machines that operated in the country back in 1994. The regulators felt that rather than prohibit gambling outside of casinos, they would find another mechanism to allow this gambling so that it could take place in an orderly and regulated fashion. They then put limitations on it so that the only venues in which this kind of gambling can take place is licensed bars, sports clubs, pubs, and betting outlets. So the idea is that there has to be a primary business before you can actually add the limited payout machines. There are also limits placed on the number of these machines per venue, and at the moment the limit is up to a maximum of 5, and in exceptional circumstances the National Gambling Board authorizes up to 40. There are only two provinces that actually have a few sites where there are as many as 40 limited payout machines per venue. The other restriction is on the stake and prize. You can only bet R5, a maximum of R5, and you can only win R500. No jackpotting is allowed. And in terms of licensing of the owner, the strict probity requirements, exactly the same probity requirements as apply to casino operators or bingo operators, apply to licensed sites for limited payout machines. For members who aren't entirely clear as to what a limited payout machine is, it is a slot machine, a normal gambling machine that you would find in a casino, but because of its limited payout capability, it's referred to as a limited payout machine. The National Gambling Act of 1996 then took up this policy that had been adopted within the provinces, and in 2007 promulgated a specific separate set of regulations to regulate the limited payout machine industry. It included the restrictions that I've mentioned, and two new elements were added, one being a three-phase rollout of the LPM machine cap in the country. 50,000 machines are allowed in terms of the national regulations in the country, but provinces are allowed only to roll out 50% of their allocation in the first phase, 35 in the second, and 15 in the third. But in order to get to the next phase, socioeconomic studies have to be undertaken and representations made to the National Gambling Board. So it's not just a national progression. There's also a new requirement in terms of which the National Gambling Board approves sites in excess of 5 limited payout machines. And in order to, so submit an application like that, one has to satisfy a number of different criteria that are laid down by the National Gambling Board. All of these provisions that I've referred to were then included in the 2004 National Gambling Act, and they are the constraints within which the industry operates today. I'd like to just emphasize that by saying that there are constraints within the law, I'm not complaining. Some of those constraints are necessary, and they're constraints that we're perfectly happy to operate within. But there are some which are now starting to impact on our businesses, and I would request that the honourable members consider the proposals that we will make in order to make life a little bit easier for ourselves as well as for the regulators, because ultimately they're two role players in this game. Just having a broad look at the limited powered machine industry as it exists today, there are six provinces that have now licensed route operators. I've listed them in the order in which they all came online. They started with Mpumalanga in April 2004. There are two licensed operators in that province. Only one is active. And a number, they allow to license up to 2,000 LPMs in the first phase. Eastern Cape, June 2005, two operators. They also have 2,000 LPMs available. Western Cape, in June 2005, where there are two operators, each with licenses to operate 1,000 machines. KwaZulu-Natal has four operators, each also licensed to operate 1,000. In Limpopo, there's one operator licensed to operate 1,000. And in Gauteng, five operators, also each licensed to operate 1,000. The number of LPMs that have been licensed is not necessarily a reflection on the number of LPMs that have been rolled out in those provinces. And just for interest's sake, in Mpumalanga, about 700 of that 2,000 LPM cap have already been rolled out. In Eastern Cape, it's 1,294. In the Western Cape, it's approximately 1,600. In KwaZulu-Natal, 1,800. And in Limpopo, 484. Gauteng, I don't know the numbers because the industry has just started licensing and they're busy rolling out at a fairly slow pace. I'm sure there may be some speakers, or you may have already had written representations about some of the difficulties they've experienced in that province. The limited powered machine industry hasn't just sort of happened in a vacuum. There are a lot of socioeconomic requirements placed on operators, particularly route operators, very much like the sort of considerations that were attached to the licensing of casinos. Route operators were also seen as a way in which government could stimulate certain areas of the economy. And in order to win licenses, route operators had to demonstrate a commitment and make undertakings in terms of job creation and the adoption of employment equity policies. There's also, because it is a fairly specialized area, training and skills development is required. And certainly in our particular operation, we have a training center where we train all the site's employees. Just by way of example, if a pub has five limited payoff machines in it, it needs at least 3 to 5 extra staff in order to monitor those machines for the duration that they're on. So we bring those staff into our training center and we train them up. So there's a degree of, a very good degree of training and skills development. And then at the route operator level, there's also obviously training and skills development at a slightly different level. We've found that a lot of the employees at trust level who've been to our training and who've gained experience in the industry are now able to get jobs in casinos and other industries which pay a little bit better than the sort of pay that they didn't have. So from an employment creation point of view, it has had quite a number of positive spin-offs. The issue around broad-based economic empowerment is also addressed to this industry through ownership of not only ownership within the route operator business, but likewise in the site, and also management participation, both obviously on our boards and at the individual sites. The nature of our industry is also such that it has a very wide geographic footprint, achieving broad-based ownership of sites by people within the community, and because of the BEE requirements, there's also a very widespread of business amongst black people. The limited pouch machine industry is probably one of the few industries that can actually boast in terms of doing a lot for small and medium enterprise development, because that's the very nature of our business. We, as route operators, and like all the other route operators do, when we have a site licensed and we install our machines, we actually do a fit-out within that site. We spend a fairly considerable sum of money on that. We also need to obviously procure the different supplies that we need to do that fit up, carpet, paint, machine bases, chairs, and so on. And we have certain requirements in terms of having to spend a certain amount of our procurement budget with small enterprises, and obviously also enterprises that are owned by black people. Route operators also typically have community social investment initiatives, and they undertake in their bids to make serious contributions to community social development projects. And typically the type of contribution that would be made is between 2% and 5% of a route operator's pre-tax profits. The industry has also been potentially a new source of revenue for national and provincial government. We are finding that the regulators put a lot of emphasis on route operators actually formalizing the businesses of the sites when they apply for licenses. So a lot of these businesses that were run informally previously, a lot of them weren't registered to pay tax. But in order to get a license, you have to have a tax clearance. So a lot of those businesses are now part of the tax network. So there's been that positive spin-off as well. We also subscribe to the National Responsible Gambling Program. We all make a 0.1% contribution, first gaming revenue contribution to the National Gambling Responsible Gambling Program, recognizing the good work that it does. And we, in fact, also, certainly within our operation, some of the training which is given to the site employees also includes an awareness around these issues on problem gambling. Obviously, people at site level aren't qualified to do counselling, but we have literature on site, and the staff are trained to draw players who potentially may have problems to draw their attention to that literature. Getting down to the meat of this presentation, the problems that we feel we'd like to draw to your Honourable Committee's attention, Madam Chair, are the need to actually review the legislative framework, given that it was mooted back in 1995. And obviously things like the stake and prize limits would have been set at a time when there was a different value attached to R5 and R500. You know, that amount has remained static for at least 12 years. And if one has to compare the changes in the consumer price index over that period, at today's CPI, R5 would be at least equivalent to 10, and the R500 would be at least equivalent to R1,000. I did include with our written representations a table of the CPI changes over the years to back that up, and we would recommend very conservatively that the committee consider supporting a change in the stake and price limits. It is a competence of the Minister of Trade and Industry to amend those stake and price limits, but I think if the policy was being formulated at this level, it would be very helpful for the industry. It certainly would enable us to continue doing the good work and providing socioeconomic benefits that I've already outlined. One of the other problems we have is with the central monitoring system. What this means is all of the limited payout machines have to be connected to a national monitoring system. And we are finding that as the provinces are starting to issue licenses and as more and more limited payout machines are brought online, the monitoring system is really having problems coping with the demands that are placed on it. It does a good job. It was designed, it's a specific system designed for this market, and I do know that a reasonable amount of investment has been made in it. But the operators have had several years of being a single operator, and I think their contract with the National Gambling Board runs to about 2012, and I'm not suggesting that contract be terminated before that, but I think the time is now appropriate also for attention to be given to an amendment to the National Gambling Act to accommodate more than one monitoring system. There are a number of monitoring systems available on the open market. Many of them are used to great effect by the casino, and they can be adapted for use in the limited payout machine industry. Provided these systems comply with the national certification requirements and are approved by the National Gambling Board, I see no reason why route operators shouldn't have a choice of monitoring systems. The last issue, or second to last, and probably the most important, is the problem of illegal gambling, and particularly the illegal online gambling. We, along with all the other operators in the industry, are finding that this prevalence of illegal gambling in society to actually be a problem for us. It undermines our product. It also erodes the investment that we've all been forced to make into the industry, and obviously which we're quite prepared to make. And we would like to prevail on the Honourable Committee to consider moving the internet gambling legislation along. And the Act has been passed, but there need to be certain other regulations promulgated in order for it to be implemented. And I do think that it would be helpful if this committee could assist with getting that legislation promulgated. I know there will be speakers coming after me who will address that, and I believe the committee's also received written representations. So I'm not going to belabor that point other than to request that the committee give it serious consideration. One last issue, and it's not really something that I believe falls directly within the hands of this committee, but it is something which may be able to come out as a policy recommendation, and that is that the gambling regulators work a little bit harder to achieve consistency in the manner in which the different gambling acts are implemented and how they are interpreted. As an operator that operates in two provinces, we sit with having to do things differently in each of the provinces. And basically, it's the same legislation that comes out of the same national norms and standards. There are also operators who operate in all of the six provinces, so I shudder to think how difficult it must be for them. And likewise for the manufacturers who supply to the different industries in nine different provinces, and they also need to deal with the National Gambling Board. So that really is a problem that all of the operators experience, and again, I would prevail on the committee to give that serious thought. And Madam Chair, with that, I'd just like to sum up the proposal to increase the steak and price limits in line with CPI to 10 rand for the steak and 1,000 rand price, to amend the National Gambling Act to allow for more than one monitoring system to be used in the limited payout machine industry, but subject obviously to the monitoring system being certified and licensed by the National Gambling Board. We would urge that the National Gambling Amendment Act, number 10 of 2008, be implemented in order to, I've said reduce, but I would like to be optimistic and say eliminate illegal internet gambling. And then an interprovincial initiative to achieve consistency in the interpretation and application of the various gambling laws. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much to yourself for that very concise presentation, Ms. Parker. And what we will do, honourable members, is to allow just a six-minute opportunity for a specific engagement, 6 to 7, and then afterwards we'll have a more general questions to those who've made the presentation. So if there's anyone who would like to ask any clarification with respect to the presentation you've heard or question, please do so. I'm only going to allow one question per person, please. Two, if it occupies less than a minute. Thank you. Honourable Mabasa, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Turok, was your hand up? Yes. Honourable Van de Westhuizen and Honourable Marais, in that order.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Once more, very sorry to your family for this loss. Hope you come strong. I just missed the full meaning of LPM.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the very first slide, where we spoke about the rollout of the LPM, limited payout machines, that it is 50% and then followed by 35, 15 in the third phase. They said that there's a social economic impact which is done, or a study is done, before these things are being increased. So who does that study? What about? Are the members of the community where they're operating involved? Just like the leaders, they say the churches, the civic organizations, are they involved in that study?
Yeah, I wonder if the speaker is aware of the fact that we get frequent reports that despite the regulation and the limitation of sites, that in fact this kind of the payout machines are spread very widely, and that authority, try as they might, cannot effectively supervise the number of payout machines that exist throughout the country, but particularly in this province. So, are you aware of the fact that despite the official limitations, there are indeed frequent reports of far more machines being around? And this has been the case for many years. So that the moment those machines are released and manufactured, they do find their way into the communities in all sorts of undesirable places. And since we are the legislators, what do we do about it? Chair, I wonder if I might also ask a question about moral values, which come from Professor Peter Collins' paper before us.
Well, you have 10 seconds.
Okay. In Professor Peter Collins' document here, it says, gambling is an inherently undesirable activity which people ought not to engage in. And then he goes on to discuss that. What is your view? Is it an inherently undesirable activity or not? Thanks.
Thank
Thank you. Honourable Van der Westhuizen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to some of the other colleagues that have already touched on some of my questions regarding, for example, the socioeconomic study. I will then limit my question to how are the operators organized, and secondly, what do they do to assist in the curbing of illegal gambling? Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Murray.
Thank you, Chair. If my assumption is correct and following up on what Honourable Turok has said, my assumption is that most of these are in small outlets, quite widely spread over the provinces, SMME shops, cafes, etc. Do you know how many of these are in the countryside? And in that countryside, you know, where in that town will be your target market area? And then following on that, how do you control that your operations are not used for money laundering? You know, what controls have you got in that regard? Thank you.
And for Marcel, please. One of the last points that you made was with respect to the inconsistent interpretation of laws by regulators, and specifically you were referring to provincial implementation. Exactly, could you be more specific and try to do that in concisely, please, in 5 minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first question, asking the meaning of limited payout machine. A limited payout machine is like a gambling machine, which is found in a casino, but it has limited payout potential, so or capability. It only can pay out a maximum of 500 Rand for a successful game, and you can only bet 5 Rand, a maximum of 5. So you can't win more than 500 Rand for your 5 Rand. The next question, as to the study that needs to be undertaken in order to get to the next, the second phase or the third phase, the province that is making representations to the National Gambling Board for authority to roll out a limited payout machines as part of its second phase would have to commission a socioeconomic impact study, and it would have to make representations to the National Gambling Board for that. It's not representations that can be made by the industry. They're not invited to make those representations. It falls to be dealt with by the provincial regulators. As to the question on as to whether I was aware of the number of reports that have been made to various members about the spread of these machines, I'm not aware that there have been complaints about that. It sounds to me from what the Honourable Member is saying that it's a lot of illegal machines that are somehow finding their way into the market. We are regulated operators, and the Gambling Board has a very, very wide reach in all of the provinces in terms of the number of machines that are out there. All of these machines have to be linked to a monitoring system, and the regulators have access to the data that comes out of that monitoring system, as do the operators. So any machine which is out there which doesn't have a certification and registration number on it means that it hasn't been certified and it hasn't been approved by the National Gambling Board as being a machine that can be used in the country. And if it's not connected to the monitoring system, it means it's not a licensed machine by a provincial gambling board. So I have to say that those machines are not legal machines. They would be illegal machines. As to the question of my comments on what Professor Peter Collins has said, that gaming inherently is undesirable, It really is a matter of opinion. Some people think gambling is a wonderful activity. Some people derive great pleasure out of doing it. Not all people who gamble have problems. In fact, a very small percentage of people who gamble have problems. So for a vast majority of society, gambling is a pleasurable activity. There are also elements within society that find it to be undesirable. And as regulators, I was a regulator back in 1995 and I was involved in the policy development process. And we spent a long time debating as to whether we should have prohibition or whether we should allow gambling. And we felt that there clearly was a demand in society, given the number of illegal machines that were in the country at the time, which were estimated at about 100,000 conservatively. We felt that it would probably serve society better to legalize gambling and have it take place on a regulated basis. The findings that the National Responsible Gambling Program has made since they started their various studies is that with regulated gambling, they've been able to get a much better handle on this whole issue around problem gambling. And because help is readily available, it appears that the number of people who are presenting with these problems has actually leveled off. So given that scenario, I believe that we've actually done well in terms of having a regulated industry. But if there are illegal machines out there, then I believe we need to let the authorities know so that they can act accordingly. That also sort of semi-answers the question from the Honourable Member van der Westhuizen. You asked how are operators organised and what do we do to stop the illegals. Believe you me, we don't like illegal operators any more than this house or anybody else does. We would report it to the authorities. We would work closely with the gambling boards if we needed to, in order to bring those operators to book and get those machines out of the system. In terms of how the operators are organized, I wasn't entirely sure what your question meant, so I'm not sure if Madam Chair would allow you to perhaps just elaborate.
You belong to a communal society of operators, for example.
Yes, there is a limited payout machine association, which is a Section 21 company. The Honourable Member Murray mentioned that limited payout machines are placed in small outlets like cafes. I need to correct that perception. Limited payout machines are not allowed in places like cafes. They are only allowed in venues that have an age-controlled operation within it. So in other words, like a liquor, a bar, or a betting outlet, where there's already a primary business, but certainly not in cafes and like a widespread in areas where they shouldn't be. In fact, the gambling boards, and this is one of the areas, if I may, just also, Madam Chair, sort of touch on the question that you raised in terms of the inconsistency is, the gambling boards don't allow us to have limited payout machines in close proximity to churches, places of worship, and schools, any educational institution. And on pension payout day, any limited payout machines within a certain radius of a pension pay point has to actually be switched off. So there are those requirements, but the provinces all have different radii, so to speak, or different sort of standards in terms of how they measure the distance between a gambling or a limited payout machine and a place of worship or an educational institution. As to our target market, we typically would target a high earning income area because obviously that's what drives business. But we also, from a responsible point of view, would not necessarily target a market where people could ill afford to gamble. So, you know, money drives this operation, and it's not commercially viable to install machines in depressed areas, and nor would we want to. So basically high street areas where there are people and areas where people have a certain amount of disposable income to spend on this kind of entertainment activity. How do we control money laundering? We obviously are required to comply with the requirements of the Financial Intelligence Centre Act, and we do have measures in place at site level where the employees who monitor these gambling machines are required to report any suspicious activity. Given that our industry is limited stakes and payout, we find the incidence of money laundering actually negligible because it's not really feasible for someone who's laundering large quantities of money to do it through our machine. Madam Chair, and then finally, your question around inconsistent.
You will now convey your response in writing to the committee secretary, as we've run out of time now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And we now turn to AG Consulting, RNGL. Thank you very much. We can do that with haste. I'd prefer it if you did not sit there. That's what I'm trying to indicate, madam. And I would prefer it if you either sat at the back there or took the opportunity to avail yourself of one of the seats there. Thank you. These are the seats available for presenters. So we have... Is it the AG Consulting? Is it Miss Gibson? Right, I think you're lucky now. You've seen how things are done. So you have 20 minutes, 15 to 20. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. First of all, we'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to appear here before today. The committee has indicated on various occasions that there is an opportunity or perhaps any desirability to review certain aspects of the legislation regarding gambling in the country. I'm not going to go through the list of all the aspects which were referred to in the committee's announcement, but I'd like to address them in my presentation as I go along. Just before I do commence, I'd like to just contextualize our presence here. And tell you a bit about AG Consulting CC. We are a closed corporation. There are two members in the closed corporation, myself, I'm Advocate Alicia Gibson, and my partner on my left, Mr. Lisbeth Libman. We have 20 years collective regulatory experience. Both of us were employed in a senior management level by the Western Cape Gambling and Racing Board, each for a period of 10 years. I am legally qualified. I have legislative drafting experience and drafting experience in specifically the drafting of gambling legislation. We also have between us industry experience, and since our deciding to embark upon this venture, consulting experience in gaming law and compliance. We serve a variety of clients. We have a very good knowledge of, a broad knowledge of the various sectors of the gambling industry, both in this province and on a national level. And from that perspective, we hope to be able to just give the committee a bird's eye view of the various sectors of the gambling industry, to familiarize it with the framework within which that industry operates and the various sectors operate. Then to look at certain noteworthy exceptions to which we feel the committee might want to give attention. And then to look, finally, at policy considerations regarding interactive gambling, and more specifically, the question of prohibition on the one hand versus regulation on the other. So, taking the sector-by-sector approach, I'd like to start with the casino industry. Now, as the committee will be aware, there is a legislative cap on the number of casino licenses which may be awarded throughout the country. There are only 40 licenses available, and they are allocated in specific allocations in the various provinces. This, per se, prevents an over-proliferation of gambling activities in the country. And the starting point, really, of the legislation is that gambling, per se, is prohibited, but with the exception of X number of casino licenses, X number of limited payout machines. I'm sure the committee would be aware, and I must stress before I go any further that we appear today in our capacity independently. We're not serving any master. We have come here in a bid to try and present the factual situation to the committee in as much as we are able regarding the various sectors of the industry, so we don't appear on behalf of anybody. There has been enormous infrastructural investment and job creation, as well as revenue generation from the casino sector. To the best of my knowledge, the extent of the capital investment at this stage stands at over 19 billion rand. The job creation is in the tens of thousands, I believe somewhere between 30 and 40,000 direct jobs which have been created by this industry. And then, of course, from the point of view of taxes, both national taxes and provincial taxes, we're also talking about significant amounts of money. I'm sure that other presenters would be able to give the committee the exact details of that. As far as social impact is concerned, from the casino side, great stress needs to be placed on the role and functioning of the National Responsible Gambling Program. This is really a pioneering private-public sector partnership which has achieved massive gains in terms of the environment within which the industry functions. Over the last 10 years, and more specifically from 2003, problem gambling numbers and statistics in South Africa in fact declined, notwithstanding the growth in gambling opportunities. And this was largely as a result of public initiatives, public education initiatives that were embarked upon by this program. The program makes provision, as you will be aware, for treatment, for counseling, and for public education. And obviously the industry contributes in a huge measure to this program, which is largely probably funded as to at least 90% by the casino sector. There is close ongoing regulation of the casino industry by the various provincial gambling boards. There are national standards in place. Any gambling device that is exposed for play may not be so exposed unless it has been certified as complying with the relevant national standards. So there are standards for every type of equipment that you would find in a casino, and this equipment is then tested against those standards before it is certified as complying and able to be exposed for play. So this protects the integrity of gambling operations from the point of view of the public and therefore guarantees fair play towards the public. It's also important to note that there's a network of regulation, and this network of regulation doesn't merely exist across South Africa, it exists across the world. You often find that many role players in this industry have similar interests in other countries. Regulators internationally liaise with one another. If a gambling operator in South Africa loses its license, or has its license suspended, or has some type of disciplinary action against it, that information will spread overnight throughout the world and can jeopardize the licenses of that operator in whatever jurisdiction they may be active in. So there's no possibility of selective compliance. It's an all or nothing thing. As the previous speaker mentioned, there is to some extent a lack of uniformity and clarity as between the various provincial gambling boards in respect of certain aspects that affect the industry. For example, the committee might be aware that in 2003-2004, the National Gambling Board commissioned a BEE audit to look at the extent to which the casino sector and the gambling industry had contributed to BEE. And it found, not surprisingly, quite a fractured picture, because various gambling boards had various requirements. They were implemented differently. And so you had people with licenses in one province that had to comply with much lesser or much greater criteria than licensees in other provinces. Notwithstanding the publication of the Codes of Good Practice on broad-based black economic empowerment, we still don't have that level of uniformity which is desirable to ensure that everybody operates within a equal playing field. So that would be something to which attention could be given over the longer term. As I've mentioned, there are contributions to NRGP and extensive social responsibility measures in the casino environment. Collateral material has to be available. Employees are trained to respond to instances of problem gambling behavior. One thing that does impact on social responsibility is the issue of advertising, and I understand that this issue has been raised at committee level before. In the Western Cape, which is distinct in this respect from other jurisdictions, gambling operators, licensees must apply to the Provincial Gambling Board, must place their proposed advertisement campaigns before the Provincial Gambling Board for approval, before those campaigns are approved. This doesn't happen in other provinces, and as a result, one has differing standards and one doesn't have that additional regulatory control to ensure that whatever is going out to the public from the point of view of the license sector is a good product and is not a misleading product. And that is something that maybe could be taken into account as a potential standard to be employed for all provincial licensing authorities. I'd like to touch, the previous speaker spoke very extensively on the limited payout machine industry. As she said, the industry does make significant contributions to SME development. Also, what the industry has done to a great extent is to bring within the compliance net and the tax net a variety of businesses that previously were just not compliant with the laws of the country in terms of taxes, in terms of registration for levies, in terms of business licenses and the like. So that has been a very good byproduct of this industry. The regulatory reach is extensive. There's involvement invariably because of the nature of LPM operations with other regulatory authorities such as liquor boards and authorities such as this, as well as the local authority as far as land use side of sites, licensed sites is concerned. There are enormous operational constraints for this industry in respect of zoning particularly. The National Gambling Act presently states that a license cannot be granted to an applicant if the premises is not appropriately zoned for the purpose for which it's going to be used. Unfortunately, in rolling out or attempting to roll out these operations in the traditionally black areas, these areas are not zoned at all. So it makes it very difficult for the operators to comply with their commitments and also to make sure that there's a spread of these machines in areas where they should be. In certain provinces there's been a suspension of the licensing process, so there is a bit of a fractured operation of the industry at the moment, and there is disparity in provincial approaches. So we would suggest that what is required to address this would be the standardization of certain basic procedures in regard to advertising, in regard to uniform national criteria for the licensing of sites. Public hearings also pose the problem, although there are national regulations to this effect. Some boards insist on holding public hearings in all cases, notwithstanding that the requirements are different. And then site location requirements. We would suggest that if standards could be put together on a national level for these things, it would make the operation of the industry a lot smoother and better. The bingo industry, the development of this industry has been fragmented in that when the provincial legislation pertaining to gambling was drafted, provision was made for the licensing of bingo operations. And at that time, the only bingo that existed was traditional bingo, where people actually sat in a bingo hall and cards were physically handed to them, and the operator would announce the numbers and the player would cross off the number and there would be an interactive type of environment. However, in the interim, machines called electronic bingo terminals, EBTs, were introduced. And they were licensed by certain of the provincial boards. This gave rise to a legal dispute, and the essence of the dispute is that the EBTs are nothing more than slot machines in disguise, that they do not, in fact, operate, they do not offer the game of bingo. The High Court in the Transvaal, it was then called Provincial Division, found that in fact these machines do not offer the game of bingo, but notwithstanding that they are still being licensed in certain jurisdictions. There is still an ongoing legal dispute, but it's something that the committee, the Honourable Committee, might find useful in its deliberations. In the totalisator industry, it seems that there is no real material problem regarding the regulation of this sector, which deals with horse racing and totalisator pool betting, and I'm not going to dwell on it. The bookmaking industry. Bookmaking industry unfortunately finds itself facing some pressure, and this is largely really just due to the structure of bookmaking operations. Bookmaking operations are typically run by one or two people. There are some corporate entities out there that are invested in bookmaking in the country, but they are still very much in the minority. Bookmaking is very specialized and very risk-based activity. The bookmaker's risks on each and every event on which he or she offers a bid takes a substantial risk and tries to lock in a profit on each subject in respect of which they're betting. The result of this is that the profit margins of bookmakers are not what the ordinary company's profit margins can be expected to be. They are typically between 6 and 8%, not only in South Africa, but internationally. So when you look at a bookmaking business and you try and classify it by using turnover, even though your turnover may be very high, your profit might be very low or even non-existent, you try and classify these businesses for the purposes of the codes of good practice on broad-based BEE, there's a problem with that. And that is something to which attention needs to be given. We would submit on a national level. Then just a note where the exceptions. Interactive gambling operators from neighboring jurisdictions, and I refer more specifically to jurisdictions such as Swaziland. These are licensed operators. They advertise openly and extensively to the South African market, as I'm sure the committee will be aware. They spend jaw-dropping amounts, as far as I'm been able to ascertain, on advertising in the South African environment. There is the Section 11, as the committee will be aware, prohibits interactive gambling, the conduct of interactive gambling in this country, and Section 15, not 13, Section 15, prohibits, forgive the misprint, prohibits advertising. The operators, there's been a legal dispute, and the operators, there was a case between the Gauteng Gambling Board and Pigs Peak, and the case revolved around where the gambling took place, because Pigs Peak, as that licensed operator, their argument was, we are situated in Swaziland, we are licensed in Swaziland, therefore the activity that we are, the person that when a gambler plays on our site, he plays on our server in Swaziland. The gambling is not taking place in South Africa, therefore there's no illegal activity, therefore the advertising of that activity is also not illegal. It's necessary if one wants to ensure the success of potential licensed internet gambling operations in South Africa to close this loophole, and it can be very easily done. And it can be simply done by inserting the provision into the National Gambling Act, which deems interactive gambling to take place where the player is located, in cases where the operator is not licensed in this country. That will entirely eliminate the difficulties that have been experienced today. Then, just briefly, the National Lottery. The National Lottery is an exclusive national competence. It seems that that Schedule 4 of the Constitution, which places the lottery in another category, has been misinterpreted to mean that play on the lottery is not a form of gambling. And as a result, there are a number of differing standards, let's put it that way, in respect of the National Lottery. There are a vast number of outlets throughout the country. They're readily accessible to underage persons. There are extensive unregulated advertising campaigns in respect of the lottery. More recently, cellular telephone and electronic banking connectivity has been introduced. And strangely enough, Section 10B of the Lotteries Act itself enjoins the Lotteries Board to ensure that the net proceeds of the National Lottery are as large as possible. Also, significantly, the operator of the National Lottery is not required to respond to contribute to the NRGP. Mm. And what we have done just briefly, Madam Chair, is to have a look at the issue of prohibition versus regulation.
in the context of interactive gambling and to offer an opinion on some of the policy issues which we understand have been raised by the committee in debating on this subject in the past. The first is that internet gambling is by its nature a borderless activity and that there will be difficulties in policing a regulated industry of this nature. We suggest that if the industry were to be prohibited, that equal levels of enforcement would still be required to police the prohibition. In other words, if you prohibit something, you have to ensure that prohibition is observed and you have to police that. Moreover, internet gambling will still continue to exist, notwithstanding the fact that it might be outlawed in this country. We suggest that as far as regulation is concerned, if there are licensed internet gambling options available to the public, these will be used in preference to illegal activities. Then increase in problem gambling. We suggest, as far as prohibition is concerned, that there would still be problem gamblers that would seek out opportunities to engage in interactive gambling, irrespective of whether it were illegal. The land-based illegal operations were considerably higher in the past before gambling was legalized than they are today. And it's a similar scenario we suggest with interactive gambling. As I've indicated previously, the research in South Africa conducted showed that from 2003 to 2007, problem gambling numbers had in fact declined, notwithstanding the increased availability of gambling options to the public. We would also suggest, as far as regulation is concerned, that it needs to be taken into account that in the context of interactive gambling, there are inherent limits on the people that will make use of this service, because one needs to have access to the internet, one needs to have a banking account, one needs to have a credit balance in the banking account. So these in themselves operate as forms of control, which would support the regulation of the industry. And we also suggest that contributions from the licensed IG operators would expand the reach of the NRGP. Money laundering. From the context of prohibition, we suggest that if this activity is prohibited, money laundering activities are in fact far more likely to flourish than they would be if it were regulated, because if you regulate something, then you require your licensed operators to comply with provisions such as are found in the Financial Intelligence Center. If you don't, and you find your citizenry are going abroad to engage in this type of activity, then obviously none of those controls are present. In the regulated environment, those controls will be present. The operators will be required to comply with all the relevant provisions of FICA. And in any event, since one has to have a nominated banking account, when you put your funds into your banking account, you will have been FICA'd. You will have been cleared from the perspective of the Financial Intelligence Center Act. So those additional controls will then inevitably be in place in the regulated environment. Underage play, to the extent that interactive gambling will be available in South Africa, notwithstanding the fact that it's outlawed, we suggest that irresponsible behavior by those adults who allow their children or people under the age of 18 to engage in this type of behavior will not cease by reason thereof. However, regulation will ensure that age verification procedures are followed, and that will also introduce independent sources of age verification, which would have to be made use of by licensed operators. Finally, revenue, employment, and infrastructure. In terms of prohibition, there would be none if no licensed interactive gambling were allowed in this country. In the event of regulation, obviously tax revenue to the national government, employment opportunities, and infrastructural investment. Morality, largely. We suggest that, although, as the previous speaker has said, this is a very relative issue, prohibiting this type of activity on a moral basis will not prevent unlawful interactive gambling play and will not minimize the availability of these options to the public. From the point of view of regulation, we think, with respect to the Honourable Committee, that this regulation of this industry will give the public a legitimate internet gambling option rather than criminalizing participation. And generally, that public acceptance levels in respect of gambling in South Africa have been shown to be good. In fact, they stand at approximately 80%, with
with people, most people acknowledging that gambling activities are a legitimate form of entertainment. And that would be
very much.
Advocate, I see it is. Advocate Gibson. Right. We're going to be limiting this to four hands. Please do as you did last time. Thank you, Honourable Turok, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable van der Westhuizen, and Honourable Mabasa.
My question is, I've just
seen
that the previous one, in your experience, what is the effectiveness
What is the effectiveness of policing unregulated gambling? Because the margin between what is permissible and what is not is often unclear. So, do you have any research? Do you know what is the scale of gambling which is although formally regulated by regulation, but is not actually policed effectively? What is that? That's my first point, and it relates to my second point. The evidence seems to be that more black players play other games, I'm not talking about lottery, than white players. In other words, and they do it in informal settings as opposed to formal settings. So it looks as though, from the evidence, that more black persons play other games, which is a variety, than white people, and they do it in an informal setting rather than in a formal setting. And that would cause some concern, because that means, it relates to my first point. If you're going to regulate something, and it's in a casino with a big building and so on, that is easily policed. And as was indicated last time, where the machine is licensed and so on, perhaps. But it seems there's a great deal of gambling which goes on in informal settings by black people and which is not easily regulated. Your comment, please.
Honorable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think this issue is coming again in this presentation, from the previous presentation, the issue of lack of regulatory uniformity between the provincial. What is it which leads not to have the same, you know, or pinpoint the areas where there are differences? Thank you.
Paul van der Westhuizen.
Thank you, Chief. The perception is that gambling is a highly profitable operation. From the days of Saul Katzner and those scientists and so on. Yet, during the previous presentation, we've seen that not all the licenses or all the operator licenses have been taken up already. Is it highly profitable? Why is there a delay? Is it a commercial consideration, or is it the regulatory framework that causes these delays in the growth of the industry?
Thank you. Honourable Mabasa.
Education. If all of us were asked here whether we would want our children to participate in education, surely we would all say yes. But when it comes to gambling, if I was to try here and take a risk and say, all of us, those that we want our children to play gambling, raise our hands, it's possible that no hands will rise. Is it because gambling, if there was so much virtue with gambling, noting that it's played above 18, I mean, it's supposed to be above 18, my argument is that I think gambling is a destructive thing in life. Well, your comments.
Thank you. One from myself. So far we've heard an emphasis on its economic benefits, including jobs and more jobs and more jobs. Well, let's accept that a certain amount of jobs are created, no doubt. However, I want to put it to you that in your opinion, does it actually have a positive impact on the unemployment rate itself? And secondly, the issue which you yourself and others, one other person referred to, was that, you know, it was positive for that area, as it were. And yet, a study has shown that very often small shops are forced out of business during this kind of process, and there is an increase in the number of pawn shops in the area, and second-hand goods shops, and debt problems, and so on. Just your comments on that, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In relation to the first question, the effectiveness of police in unregulated gambling, that is a very vexed and problematic issue. As the history of this country and regulation in this country and the absence of regulation in this country prior to 1994 has in fact revealed, there are tremendous difficulties encountered in policing prohibitions. As far as the involvement of black persons in other forms of gambling is concerned, I am aware, Madam Chair, of involvement and quite extensive involvement in community-based games of Farsi. However, I'm not at liberty to hazard a guess as to the extent of that involvement or the number of people or the locations at which these activities take place. I do understand that it is prevalent and that it occurs on a community basis, but I'm not aware of any empirical research that would enable me to make any positive or definite assertions as far as the prevalence of this activity is concerned. But I do understand that it is prevalent. As far as the question of the Honourable Khadebe, the lack of regulatory uniformity, in the context, for example, of LPMs, would be in respect of what types of sites qualify for licensing, what types of requirements the individual provincial licensing authorities place, what are their radii in terms of the proximity of certain types of premises such as educational institutions, pension payoff points, public hearings, whether public hearings are to be held in all cases or only certain cases. There are a number of instances in which the imposition of further requirements that are not necessarily contained in the legislation itself creates further stumbling blocks towards licensing. And then, of course, one has the issue of the zoning on top of that, which makes the environment very challenging. In response to the query of the Honourable Van der Westhuizen, I'd just like to point out that the previous speaker spoke about delays in the context of the LPM industry only, and not in the context of other sectors. These delays, they can arise as a result of any combination of the factors that I've just mentioned, as well as approvals required from other authorities, such as liquor licensing boards, such as local authorities in the context of business licenses. Often you find also that these local authorities and all liquor licensing authorities feel that they have a mandate also to comment upon whether gambling is a desirable or undesirable form of activity. And in that way, there can be confusion between who's doing the regulating on what level. As far as the final question from the Honourable Member Mabasa is concerned regarding gambling as a destructive activity, there are certainly people in society that hold that view. And as the previous speaker said, I'd just like to underline what she said, that is a matter of opinion, but a survey that was conducted quite recently in 2005, as I've indicated, and stretched across 3,100 households in South Africa, across the country, found that the acceptance of gambling as a legitimate leisure activity stood at 80%. However, it would be our submission that to regulate an activity such as this will always give you preferable outcomes than to prohibit it, because by prohibiting it, you're not going to bring about the cessation of the activity itself. With regulation, you have controls and you have the ability to monitor the activity in question. Then finally, Chair, your question regarding the economic benefits. You asked whether there was positive impact on the unemployment rate, and I would suggest that in my experience from the casino sector, most definitely, in the sense that huge numbers of the people that were employed in the last 10 years by the casino sector were people that had never had jobs before. In other words, they were formerly unemployed, had not had work before. So I think it's fair to say that the impact is very positive. Yes, certainly. I'm not personally aware of the springing up of pawn shops and second-hand shops, specifically in the vicinity of licensed gambling premises. So it's difficult to comment on that. Unfortunately, I can't shed any light on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Advocate. As I asked the previous presenter, we would appreciate it if you would note in writing these changes that you are requiring or that you believe would assist in respect of the uniform standardization, in particular those relating to provincial regulations in that regard. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the committee also.
And Fumalera Gaming and Leisure Limited, you requested a 3-minute setup. You have your 3 minutes. Thank you. We adjourn for 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Johnny. Where's Johnny? Johnny, please get everyone.
I did address a few words to Fumalelo. I was, after all, in Gauteng as chair of finance and economics for 10 years, and I met them there also on the other side of the table like this. So I greeted them because, of course, yes, we've met. Thank you. So I think you're aware of things. We are running a bit tight, so if you will just be extremely concise, I think that it's going to be helpful to us, and in the time that we are allocating in that regard, yes, there we are, we'll be allocating as again 15, try to complete it in 15 minutes, but at the outside 20 minutes itself, and so it's over to Mr. Ramaphosa. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, honorable members. My name is Mpho Ramaphosa, as you've heard. I'm with me, my colleague, Lawrence Kopolo, representing Phumelela Game and Leisure. I'm going to, in the interest of time, skip a couple of the slides, and you'll probably have time to read them in the handouts. The agenda covers the issues raised by the committee's notice on the public hearing. We will not address every single one of them in detail. Phumelela is licensed to operate horse racing and totalizator in 7 of the 9 provinces. The 2 provinces we're not operating in is KZN and Western Cape. Provinces are asterisked on the presentation represent provinces where we have 5 race courses and allied training centers. Between us and Gold Circle, who operate in KZN and Western Cape, we stage approximately 250 race meetings annually. Phumelela has over 230 betting shops. These are TAB branches and agencies. The agency network is essentially a semi-franchise system where independent business people are given a right to operate their tap on behalf of Pumelela. We do have two call centers, one in PE and another one in Johannesburg. The PE one is the condition of our license, and I'll talk slightly about it later on. We do also offer betting online, simply because betting is not defined as gambling. We commingle our pools with Gold Circle. Commingling means we do combine our pools between Gold Circle and Pumelela to create one national pool. You mentioned Gold Circle's operations. Pumelela and Gold Circle also have an interest in fixed odds through our shareholding in Betting World. Betting World is one of the few corporate bookmakers available in South Africa. And this I'll also refer to in detail later on. This was one of our strategies when the so-called open bet was legalized, and we needed to find a defensive mechanism to fund horse racing. So between us and Gold Circle are really the core of the horse racing industry. The totalizator funds horse racing. Just to give you an idea, the owners of horses invest anything between 180 and 210 million annually buying thoroughbred horses. And the stake money we pay that's generated through the tote has got a significant shortfall, so they don't all get their return. And therefore, they're in the game providing their product for us to be able to harness. And between Pumelela and Gold Circle, we've contributed tens of thousands of jobs, both directly and indirectly. If I may put it this way, there's about 6,500 horses in training. And for every horse in training, there are between 3 and 8 direct and indirect jobs created. I mean, for every racing stable, you have a trainer who has an assistant trainer. You do have a stable hand between a few horses. And you do have a groom per horse. And if you look at the industries that horse racing support, you're looking at the breeding industry. I mean, I've spoken about the 200 odd million that the owners invest in that industry. You've got vets, supporters, the tech and feed merchants, transport, textile, media. As Pumelela and Gold Circle, we do publish some of the racing pages in some of the major publishing houses in South Africa, and help in that regard. And horticulture is one of the industry we support, and the list goes on. We jointly own with Gold Circle Teletrack, which is one of the DSTV channels. I might add, Madam Chair, we're the only sport that has to fund its own broadcasting. I'm sure everyone would have heard what rugby, soccer gets paid to be on television. We own this particular channel. Internationally, Pumelela is continued to expand its presence, harnessing the technology and the intellectual rights we have. We do own an interest in a company on the Isle of Man. We do have exclusive worldwide broadcasting rights to some race courses in the UK, where we've got the ability to package the racing and broadcast it in over 50 countries worldwide. And I've spoken about Teletrack. We have a similar television station which we call Racing Internationally that does it internationally. I'm not going to go through the target demographics. You'll read that and see. Predominantly black, male, and between the ages 13 and 14. The popularity of horse racing globally, as you can see, the number in South Africa way below what you can see in the list on the list in other countries. The slide continues to talk about the global reach I've just mentioned. Just as a matter of interest, I've just been talking about the sporting sector in general, and you will see that, in fact, we rank high up there with the popular sports, but we don't receive a cent of corporate sponsorship. When I say a cent, to the extent that the other sports get. I mean, we do have sponsorship for running our races, but not for broadcasting rights as is happening with other sports. Just the distribution of these race meetings that I've referred to in the various provinces. We do have a vertically integrated model, and we're the only country, by the way, where horse racing is integrated, and that has given us a foothold internationally. Because when we go out there and try and present the product, we don't have to negotiate with 100 other partners to bring their product on board. And that's what's given us an advantage internationally. Those are some of our brands. Pumelela owns the most obvious betting brand, TAB. Very well, I've referred to the third line, the publications that I was referring to, amongst others, in addition to what's on in papers like the Star, the Citizen, and the equivalent of those in the Western Cape and in PE. That's just an overview of our structure as Pumelela. Now, on the socio-economic impact of legalized gambling, horse racing and betting in general accounts for less than 10%, and I'm talking about nationally. And then Pumelela's share of that 10% would probably, I mean, if you think that roughly, it looks like the split between tote and fixed odds is about 50-50, and we then have 60% of that 5%, so just around 3.1%. That's what Pumelela would have as a command of the industry. We have a level A empowered at triple BE rating with 50.23% like ownership, and Pumelela's empowerment story is one of the successful unknown stories. Pumelela was listed on the JSE May 2002, Madam Chair, as you say. This was after your committee then in Gauteng and the then NEC instructed horse racing to corporatize and transform. Pumelela listed at 50 cents at that stage. We paid dividends way in excess of that. So the people who invested in Pumelela back then have actually recouped their investment actually in the first 2 years of us being listed. By having paid that in excess of dividends. Directly, we employed 2,000 people. I've referred to the different other indirect job opportunities created. Taxations and fees, obviously, as a contributor to the provincial and national fiscal, 160 million we paid in taxes for the year ended July this year, and 200 million in the prior year, obviously, the recession. Down the number slightly in a few other factors. Regulated and responsible gambling. I think it's well known that the industry is highly regulated with emphasis on player protection. And the various gaming boards are very strict provincially in enforcing this. National responsible gambling, the national responsible gambling programs have been alluded to. And we do contribute to the program, and the program continues to educate our staff in assisting with preventing these negative effects of problem gambling. And I think I must also add, Madam Chair, the studies conducted by the NRCP suggest that we are well below the global norm on problem gambling. Impact of misleading advertising, I think it's already been mentioned that we are required generally to submit all our advertising and promotional campaigns to the provincial boards for promotion. However, I can't speak for illegal operators or deemed illegal operators like offshore online gambling businesses. The On the effectiveness, Madam Chair, of the current regulatory environment, I think we're probably one of the most regulated globally. And I would suggest and actually recommend that a balanced approach be considered. And when I talk about that, the efficiency of regulation, I mean, for instance, as Pumelela, we are licensed in 7 provinces and indirectly in the 2 other provinces, mainly because we've got interest in businesses that are licensed in those provinces. So we deal with those 9 provincial boards plus the National Gambling Board. I think, subject to correction, I believe that they all have different standards and there is very little cooperation there. I mean, just to give you an example, with the rollout of LPM currently, we are already licensed in all of these provinces and in Gauteng already. And Gauteng requires that we still undergo probity to some extent to allow LPMs to be placed on our betting sites. I mean, that's quite costly and quite cumbersome, Madam Chair. As I've said, that tends to increase cost of doing business and compliance overall. I've spoken about the processes. In fact, some of the provinces, they're still regulators on the old ordinance, Mpumalanga and Limpopo. Horse racing is still dealt with under the old ordinance, which makes it extremely difficult for us to operate in those provinces. The most significant of the differentials there are the taxes and levies. On the next slide, for instance, you can see I've listed the provinces on the left-hand side and the tax rates on the right-hand side from the rate and the base. You'll see that some are taxing us on takeout, which is equivalent to gross gaming revenue, and others we tax on turnover. And being almost a national company, because we do manage Gold Cycle's toll operations as well, it becomes very difficult and inefficient to operate in that kind of an environment, Madam Chair. And again, I've got there in brackets unfair competition. I mean, I do think that regulation tends to be overbearing sometimes and leads to a lot of lost opportunities. For instance, we are required to submit new rules for any new product we'd like to introduce into the market. This now needs all the gaming boards to come together, look at the rules, and that tends to take a considerable amount of time. Bookmakers and the lottery, I don't think are subjected to this requirement in terms of the rules. In fact, it's been mentioned there. The last numbers I saw of the National Lottery, they do have around 8,000 outlets. Now, this compares to about 400 total outlets if I combine our 230 odd plus Gold Cycle in the 2 provinces. And as I say, they can open and operate outlets anywhere, anytime. There doesn't seem to be these cumbersome requirements on their part. I did mention earlier I was going to talk about the open bet, which is what led us to investing in a fixed operation. Effectively, the open bet is bookmakers are allowed to offer bets that are not based on fixed odds, but they use total data results and dividends to determine their outcome. And we've seen a significant increase of this over time. And that, the open bet is now legislated. And Madam Chair, I must add, we did lose the various court cases we mounted trying to defend ourselves in this. It hasn't worked. I mean, this allows them effectively in court to unlawfully compete with us and use our intellectual property without due consideration. It's estimated that this cost totalization of operating approximately $200 million annually. And that leaves us with inadequate means of funding horse racing as an industry. You know, so the toll cannot adequately fund the horse racing industry itself. As an example, Madam Chair, every 100 rand bet on the totalizator yields 20 rand on average for horse racing, of which 6 rand goes directly into stake or prize money. And this is the prize money that I've said to saying that the guys who invested money in buying thoroughbreds are not able to match their investment with the NSSR return. If the same amount of money is spent with 6 spots and you're only 270 in provinces where it's legislated that 50% of the winning of the levy on winnings by punters must come back to horse racing, and it's not all the provinces, and already you can see what the shortfall comes to. As a matter of interest, the figures from recently we've been asked to bid for running the toad in Germany. We've looked at it and said to the German operators, we're not going to. I mean, we've looked at this and an aggregate of 10% drop over the last 10 years on the totalizator revenue in Germany as a result of open bet, amongst other things. I'm not an expert on interactive gambling, but we do have an interest in that. Some of the partners we're working with internationally have expressed an interest to partner with us in bidding for this license. But we do believe that the delay in licensing is probably meaning that we've lost significant ground in South Africa because players are already accessing these services that we've already mentioned. However, the one comment I'd like to make overall that we've made to, I think, DTI was that some of the processes on player registration compared to what's happening out there globally were unfortunately too onerous and likely probably to disadvantage a South African license operator once more. The presentation that's been handed out, so we have all of those. And Madam Chair, I think we'll take questions at this stage if there are any questions. And I will deal with all the other issues during the answer session.
Right. Certainly, I appreciate that. You've stuck well within your time limit. So let's also have those asking questions, members, to also be concise. Honourable Khademe, Honourable Mabasa, Honourable Marais.
All right, thank you, Chairperson. The question I'd like to ask here is the social economic impact of this horse racing. I can see that in one slide they say that they employ 2,000 people directly, and then at the same time there are about 1 million punters who attend the horse race, who attended the horse race, they've attended that. Ne? So how does that balance? 2,000, 1 million. So if it's 1 million who attended the horse racing, it means that there are more people outside there who are part of this industry, and they only employ 2,000. And then number two, they also want to increase the number of toads. Ne? They compare themselves with the lottery. But we know that the lottery has got a specific allocation to go and do social responsibility projects. Ne? What is it which they are doing as the gaming industry, horse gaming industry? Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Mabasa.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. My question is two of some of the challenges that we face in South Africa. One of them is job creation, but the second one is narrowing the gap between the haves and the have-nots. What role is horse riding? What role does it play in contributing to that?
Thank you. Honourable Maria.
Thank you, Chair. Two very, very brief questions. One is, who is Pumulela Gaming Leisure? I mean, who are you? I don't know if you can tell us. I know you're not a listed company, so you're a private company, if I'm correct. and you have shareholders, so maybe just give us an indication of that. The second thing is the job creation. Again, I mean, I grew up in an area where thoroughbred industry was the backbone of that industry, of that whole area in the Platteland, and I know that there's enormous spin-offs from this from only the thoroughbred side. You know, the breeding side, if I can call it that. So maybe if you have got some information, because I know there's direct employment and there's obviously spin-off employment, indirect employment as well.
Thank you. If you would respond, Mr. Ramathana.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The CSI initiatives, I mean, we do have various of those. I mean, as a matter of interest, we support the South African Mounted Police Unit in the area where our race course is located in Terfontein, and that also includes some of the Metro Police operations in that area. As part of that, we established together with SuperSports United a youth soccer academy, which we've been supporting for the last few years, and we have also taken part in sponsorship of the main SuperSports United team, and those are some of the initiatives. We've also, I mean, I can respond in detail in writing if need be on those. In Port Elizabeth, we do have over 100 families on one of our properties that we're working with, trying to ensure that there is accommodation for them. They call squatters because they came illegally onto our property, but we'd like to donate some of the land to them. And then if we're working with various other NGOs in being part of their responsible citizens. If I need to give an exact breakdown in detail of those, I can do that in writing, Madam Chair. On the gap between the haves and the have-nots, I think that's the problem facing all of us as South Africans. However, I've mentioned that Pumelela is 50.23% black owned, and our BEE story is one of the successful untold stories in terms of where the investors did not have to go and raise significant cash to invest in Pumelela, and they recouped their investment within the first 2 years of us being listed. However, I think I must mention that on the ownership of horses itself, I think I've had discussions where people say, why is it that there's not too many owners of horses? These animals are quite expensive. I mean, the price range from 230,000, and there's a horse that was just bought for 2.2 million a few days ago. So if you are a have-not like me, you can't afford to invest in it. In fact, I've also mentioned that you're not likely to recoup whatever you spend on that horse. So a lot of them do it for the love of the game. So on that part, it's difficult. On the other elements, I mean, the Lawrence is our HR and transformation executive. I mean, he's been responsible for our transformation plans. And then I've mentioned our triple BEE empowered exciting that shows that we've done quite a lot, and we still intend to do quite a lot. I mean, we to get to that level A triple BEE rating, we scored 68.1 or 2 points, yeah, almost 70. And now to get to level one, you need to score 100% plus, and we intend to increase our score by another 20 points. So we do have plans on that, and various other programs that we engage in as an industry. On who is Pumelela? Pumelela was formed when the racing clubs initially in Gauteng were asked to corporatize, and they brought their assets together and formed Pumelela. And shares were allocated to various parties, 50.23% of that to BEE companies that were relatively unknown, I think were, still are, because our approach was to to extend it to people that have never participated in equity. That was in 2002 in May as we did that. And the rest of the balance of the shareholding, the major shareholder in Pumelela is the Thoroughbred Trust, which owns 35% of Pumelela, and their sole reason for existence is the promotion and transformation within the horse racing industry itself. As you say, used to be a backbone in a particular community. Well, back in those days, it was the only game in town, obviously. Unfortunately, as I've shown, that we now account for the total betting market accounts for less than 10% of the betting market. And Pumelela was then listed on the JSE in May 2002, 50 cents, as I said. And we do operate in 7 of the 9 provinces, KZN and Western Cape being the only ones we don't. However, indirectly we do, in a sense that we manage Gold Circle's totalizator operation and we work closely with them. We've got an interest in Betting World, which is a corporate fixed odds operation owned jointly by Gold Circle and ourselves. In fact, the management has got a small stake in that particular one. I must add, one of the very few corporate bookmakers in South Africa. And we do have a presence internationally, running a tote on the Isle of Man. We have an interest in a company that runs the tote in Mauritius. And we continue to have approaches from jurisdictions like Germany, the UK, where we've been asked to come and run their totes because apparently we can do it better than some of the players out there. And that's in a nutshell who Pumelela is, Madam Chair and Honourable Members.
Just one
sorry, I the question on the 2,000 jobs vis-a-vis a million, the attendance. The attendance is if you think about what happens over, I'm sure most people know about the JNB Met here in Cape Town, the Vodacom Durban July and KZN, and not to the same extent the Summer Cup in Johannesburg later this month. What you find there is that on 4 or 5 days in a year, you have people attending race events that they would not normally. In fact, these are once-off customers. So for those particular days, we'll scale up our operation just for that particular day. But otherwise, on a normal day, the betting and racing events happen, I think on a very medium scale, if you like. So that would explain the discrepancy. So the attendance is every single person that would have come through our doors and our racetrack, including Gold Circle, for the whole year, and including those major race days that I've just mentioned.
You're talking about the fashion parade.
Yeah.
Just on the NRGP, though, I wanted to clarify and just hear one short response from you. Are you a member or not a member?
We are a member of the NRGP and do contribute.
Right, thank you. We appreciate your presentation. If we do require anything else, you will be asked to put this in writing. And just those two presenters who came before you, we would want to have this back by Friday, please. Friday afternoon, 2 p.m. Thank you very much, because, of course, you've got all the information already. Thank you. So, thank you very, very much. And, Ramaphosa, Pumelela. We now have the opportunity, members, of just clarifying our tea break. But meanwhile, of course, we could ask Aristocrat Gaming to come and take their seat. And if tea is available, we'll go straight into tea. If not, we'll immediately begin with Aristocrat Gaming.
that, is it Mr. Pramod Manbot, the compliance director? It certainly looks as if we have the seat. Thank you. Are you ready? See there. Right, it's 20 past 11. Can members please return at 11:30? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to sentence of investigation because that way it enables the center. They cannot be children just like some of the advocates.
Right, if we can continue. I'm assured by Aristocrat just trying to get it out. We have so many documents now in front of me. Lelo was here. Oh, sorry about that. Yes, then they're all ready to roll. And again, 15 minutes is the preferable one, as we do have the documentation. And then we'll allow the 20 if we have to.
Thank you. Madam Chairperson, honourable members of the Parliamentary Committee on Trade and Industry, thank you very much for allowing me this opportunity to address you. My name is Pramod and I'm the Compliance Director for Aristocrat Technologies Africa. We are a licensed manufacturer of electronic gambling machines and casino monitoring control systems. And we also represent of the nationally licensed manufacturers operating in the South African gaming industry. We hold up a national manufacturer license, and conditions of our licensing include subject to regulations by national and provincial gambling act rules and regulations. In terms of our location in the gaming industry of South Africa, we fall right amongst all the operators in terms of supplying product to them, and we are subject to regulation by both the national and the provincial gambling boards, and we also interact with the national regulator for compulsory specifications for the certification of gaming products and gaming systems. And we also deal with accredited test labs in the testing of our gaming products. In terms of the national gambling legislation, I think before I get to the current challenges, I will present what I would call an applause with regards to the changes that were wrought in 2004. The first positive change being the introduction of national licenses for manufacturer and key employees. Before 2004, a gaming manufacturer would have had to apply to each province for a company gaming license, as well as licenses for each of its key employees. With the introduction of national licenses in the 2004 Act, this had the rather welcome effect of saving time and money on our part in getting our company and the relevant individuals within the company licensed. The second positive development that the 2004 Act brought along was the introduction of choice with regards to licensed testing agents that can be used. In the 1996 National Gambling Act, specifically Section 13LM, the South African Bureau of Standards was the sole testing and calibration agency for gaming products in the country, and this had the rather unwelcome effect of resulting in bottlenecks and poor service delivery in the testing of gambling products for the industry. With the 2004 Act, the market has opened up, and now we have independent testing agents that provide choice to manufacturers from both a cost and a competency point of view with regards to the testing of gaming equipment. The first challenge, I would say, that the new Act brought along was just clarity on interpretation, and I refer to the Financial Intelligence Center Act. Section 37.2B of the National Gambling Act of 2004 requires, as one of the conditions of national licenses, that licensees must comply with the Financial Intelligence Center Act. I make reference to point 5.1 of my written comments for the benefit of the Madam Chairperson. Subsequent to 2004, research was conducted by the Financial Intelligence Center, the National Gambling Board, and Aristocrat, and it yielded that FICA was not designed for companies of the type that Aristocrat is. Aristocrat and other licensed gaming manufacturers like us are specifically business-to-business companies. We do not deal with the public, and therefore we are subject to regulation by both the National and Provincial Gambling Acts, as well as the Companies Act, which was amended last year. The likelihood of the business encountering any suspicious or terror financing transactions was deemed highly unlikely by the Financial Intelligence Center. Now, my recommendation for any changes that might be wrought with any amendments to the Future Act would be for Section 37.2b to be amended to reflect an exemption or clarity with regards to compliance to FICA by a licensed manufacturer. This exemption or amendment would offer a better understanding on the part of licensed manufacturers as well as regulatory authorities regarding to what degree would a manufacturer need to comply with FICA, if any, based on the Financial Intelligence Center. The second challenge that we currently experience is with regards to certification and approval of gambling machines and devices, and this is relevant to Clause 24 and 25(2) of the National Gambling Act of 2004, as well as the preamble to the National Gambling Act, which stipulates that gambling is a matter of national and provincial regulation. Reference is made to point 5.2 of my written comments for greater in-depth clarity. Current challenges are that we are limited to just one certification authority for the risk assessment of gambling machines and devices, as well as having to apply to 9 provincial gambling boards for approval of the same product. And just to give you a pictorial depiction of the flow of a product going from testing to approval and hence eventual deployment in each of the provinces, I present you this picture, which is available in the PowerPoint presentation supplied to the honorable members. Essentially, a product gets tested by a licensed testing agent, and the testing agent will produce test results and supply it to the national regulator for compulsory certifications, who are designated in terms of Section 25 of the Clause 25 of the National Gambling Act to be a certification authority. That certification, along with a test report from the testing agent, gets supplied by the manufacturer to 9 different provincial gambling boards for approval. Now, as you can imagine, the actual process of regulatory approvals at provincial level does tend to be quite time-consuming and onerous, as well as in terms of deferring interpretations of test results by different regulatory authorities, which results sometimes in some products being approved in some provinces and others not. If I can make any recommendations for any changes to be made to the National Act, I would look at Clause 25(2) to be amended to allow for multiple certification agencies, and not just the NRCS, as long as they are accredited to ISO IEC 17020, which is an international standard for the accreditation of inspection bodies. I would also look at Clause 24 to be amended to allow any testing agents that are ISO IEC 17020 that are accredited to that standard to also be certification agencies as well, as they would be best placed to do an accurate and competent risk assessment in terms of gambling equipment and devices. And I would also look at, after 12 years of a regulated gambling industry, to look at an introduction of national gambling equipment approvals for gambling equipment and devices used throughout the country. This could exist in parallel with provincial approval requirements, where certain provinces approve certain types of products and where those same products are not allowed in other provinces. So at least that avenue is still open for manufacturers to get our products to the market. Pictorially, this is the envisaged scenarios where a product is tested and certified by testing agents to SANS 1718 standards, SANS 1718 being the gambling equipment standards published by the South African Bureau of Standards. And that test and certification results are supplied to a provincial gambling board for either national gambling equipment approval or a provincial gambling board approval, depending on the type of product that's been certified. Or, alternatively, product is tested by a testing agent and the test results are supplied to any accredited test certification agency, and that certification and test results are then supplied to a provincial gambling board for either a national gambling equipment approval or a provincial gambling equipment approval. The third challenge that we currently face in terms of the daily course of our business is movements of gambling machines and devices. References clauses 19 to 23 of the National Gambling Act of 2004, as well as the preamble to the National Gambling Act of 2004 regarding national and provincial regulation of gambling industry. This is reference to 5.3 of my written comments. Currently, we have to register gambling machines and devices on a National Gambling Machines and Devices Register that's hosted by the National Gambling Board. And in addition, we have to apply to different provincial gambling boards for transportation approval to move gambling equipment and devices from our warehouse to the eventual license destination, be it a limited payout machine, route operator, or a casino operator. What this results in is, given the set of information involved, it results in duplication of work for the same set of information. The recommendation that I would make is for clauses 19 to 23 of the National Gambling Act to be amended to allow for gambling machines and devices to be registered and through which distribution approvals or maybe distribution notifications to be placed as well so that the relevant regulatory authorities are aware of the shipment of gambling machines and devices and what the destination is. The benefit this will offer to all parties involved would be the avoidance of duplication at national and provincial level, as well as the elimination of duplicate administrative processes. This will result in products entering the market far easier for manufacturers than what is currently happening. And on that note, I end my presentation and I open the floor for questions.
Thank you most sincerely, Mr. Mumbo. Thank you. Honourable members, I hope we can be concise with that. So it's over to yourselves. Honourable Mabasa.
Chair, when I look at the recommendation, the very first recommendation, will it not be, when we talk of... it's not a spec, but it's a recommendation titled Clause 25.2, and then it's followed by Clause 24. My question is it, when we talk of testing as well as certification to be one, are we not talking of at the school level, just to make a similarity? A school teaching children, but at the same time setting exams for itself, contrary to if the exams are set by an outside body. Don't we have that clash?
Thank you for the question. Currently, what's been happening in the industry in the 5 years since the National Gambling Act, it has been that whenever there are, currently what's happening in the industry is, whenever there are equipment failures or patron disputes at casino, limited payout machines, route operator sites, the compliance state of the equipment is brought into question. And what used to happen originally was that questions would be referred to the certification authority as to how could they certify certain equipment if maybe the certification has certain comments relating to possible compliance or non-compliance of the equipment. But what this resulted was that the certification authority then referred all the questions through to the test laboratories, and a lot of the gambling boards go directly to the test labs as well for direct answers in terms of the actual risk assessment and in terms of the reasons for failures of certain equipment at the casino. It's based on that, since in the 5 years since the National Act was amended in 2004, that based on what's happening in the industry at the moment, that model is being proposed, and it's also aligned with the model that's used overseas in some jurisdictions, where the test laboratory is also brought in as the forensics agency to offer a risk assessment on the gaming equipment. But at the end of the day, in terms of our provincial gambling legislation, the gambling boards will have the final approval in terms of whether a product is approved or not for use at an operator, a licensed venue in their province. The test laboratory and the certification authority will only recommend for the gambling board as to whether the equipment should be approved or not. But the final approval as part of the mandate of protection of the public, will be taken by the provincial gambling board before any equipment is allowed to be used in the industry.
Members, are there any other questions, comments? Honourable Member Vestfason.
Chairperson, I would like to ask Mr. Trumbull, just how many manufacturers are there in South Africa of these machines? How many testing facilities are there? Do you still have the same delays as you experience with the SABS, now with the, what's it, NCSR? When you say that you want more testing facilities, is that similar to the vehicle testing facilities where initially only municipalities would test, and now it's been privatized, and people go to whatever testing station they then prefer, because that gives them the best service?
Thank you very much for that question. In terms of manufacturers in the country, there are currently, there are currently about 10 manufacturers that hold national manufacturer licenses, and there are approximately another 8 that hold provincial manufacturer licenses. In other words, they only supply products to certain provinces. In terms of test laboratories, or testing agents, as they refer to in Clause 24 and 25 of the National Act, there are currently two. One is Gaming Laboratories International, and the other is BMM Compliance. When I talk about actually specifically certification agencies, not testing agents, currently the NRCS are the certification authority in terms of Section 25 of the Act, and they've also updated a lot of their procedures to be as more efficient in terms of how they do their certification of gambling equipment. But the model that I've been proposing is more in terms of a follow-on from the National Act of 2004, where we open up the industry to maybe more than one risk assessment agency from a certification point of view, and not having just one body doing all the risk assessment, and which might lead to questions in the industry if there's a product failure, in terms of maybe getting an alternative opinion in terms of the compliance state or failure of gambling equipment.
Thank you. It would be helpful if we could get just a clarification on a point which I understand you have made here, that there's currently a requirement in legislation that in the different provincial provinces you require a separate certification, as it were, on your machines, and that if that certification differs from province to province, and of course with national then. Just want to get it quite clear as to what you are saying, and then if you could give us an example.
Okay. For example, when you have equipment tested to the South African National Standard 1718 Part 1, for instance, what would happen is sometimes the testing agent might make a few comments, but comments relating to the most efficient operation of the equipment in the field. That test report goes off to the NRCS to get a letter of certification, and then it gets sent off to the different gambling boards for approval. Now, a situation arises where you have differing interpretations of the test results in the test reports, for instance, like let's just say you get a comment that says main door open, not reported by system, or for example. What we end up having is a situation where maybe 8 of the 9 gambling boards will approve the product because they don't deem it as quite a serious problem for their license venues. But then you get the one gambling board that decides he will not approve that product for use in the province because he interprets the wording as something serious. So what happens is often we'd have to go back to the test lab to get a risk assessment done on that finding to represent to the one singular gambling board just to get the product approved for use in the province. So it amounts to interpretation of comments and interpretation of the same results that are presented on the board.
Exactly what is the door on your machine?
Well, for instance, The main door on a gambling machine or a slot machine would be the door that the player is exposed to, that has the player screen and has all the cash input devices. Essentially, if there's a problem with the machine, then the technician will come and open the main door to get into the inside of the machine to fix any issues. So as required by South African national standards, whenever a main door is open, it must send a signal to whatever the casino's monitoring system or the system used by the limited guard machine operator is for audit trail purposes.
Auditing purposes?
Yes.
So if it's open, exactly how, you know, surely this would then be seen as a problem to the auditors.
Thanks. It would be. That's why each gambling board have their own gaming control department to evaluate the risk. They use the information specifically if there's a patron dispute and they need to work through the audit trail from the system to evaluate the activity on the machine. But where the challenge comes in is interpretations of these requirements from province to province, even though they are the same in all the provinces.
Thank you. Would be appreciated if you would put an expanded clarification in writing and give us something beyond the open doors, then do the open doors and give us a couple of other examples specifically. And are we talking about two or three such hazy or grey interpretive areas, or are we looking at about 20, 30, 40? What are we looking at?
Okay, that's, I can do that for you as a chairperson.
Thank you very much, though, for trying to explain the equipment to us. Certainly increased some of our knowledge. Thank you very much. And I'm sure you can liaise, is it with yourself, Ms. Herning? Yes. And you have already heard us say we would like this on Friday by 2 p.m., if you're experiencing a problem, obviously you'll get in touch with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We also now have the National Responsible Gambling Foundation, what has been referred to as the NRG, well, not the, that would have been the board, but this is the foundation that is coming before us this morning to make a submission. Thank you. What is it called? The NARGF. Right. We do have a draft submission here. Do you have a PowerPoint at all? Right, but you're not reading this out to us now, or 40-odd pages or something. So if you would speak to it, please, it would be helpful. Thank you. Do you have an executive summary?
Yes, Madam Chairman. If I may, first of all, clear up the point about the nomenclature. The South African National Responsible Gambling Foundation runs the National Responsible Gambling Program, and that has
three components: a research component, an education and prevention component, and a treatment component. So that's just to be clear about what we do.
I also just wanted to say thank you. It's Professor Peter Collins. that's making this presentation. So now, Professor Collins, please make the presentation to us. Thank you for being here. And I think you've heard we are giving 15 minutes preferably, but of course we will try to accommodate you in 20 if that's the case.
I will take my watch off to see if I cannot.
Sorry, do I have to keep pressing this?
Yes.
I will take my watch off so that I can try to accommodate you. I presented a short document and a longer document, which is the latest research findings of the NRGP, which was conducted through on 3,000 South Africans. It's a research project we have conducted four times since 2001, and we are getting a pretty accurate picture of both participation in and problem gambling within South African gambling. The only thing I would like to stress is that it does not seem to me to be my function to pass any kind of judgment on how much gambling there should be in South Africa or indeed in any other jurisdiction, of what kind, and how it should be regulated. My function as an academic is simply to say these are likely to be the consequences of pursuing that policy. And so in that sense, we at the NRGP are neutral on all forms of ethical issues relating to gambling. I thought it would be helpful if I characterized the South African situation in terms which are comparable to the international situation, and particularly politically. That is, in all societies known to me, there are people, and I believe I've been quoted saying this before, there are people who believe that gambling is immoral and should be banned. That is not actually my view, but it is a view I recognize and respect that other people have. There is an alternative view that gambling is just a form of entertainment and should be treated as such, and there should be no difference between going to a casino and going to a theater. There is a third view, which is the commonest view in most jurisdictions and is the view in South Africa, which is that gambling needs to be more carefully regulated than other forms of entertainment. The reason for that varies, but mostly it focuses on the issue of problem gambling and the capacity of gambling to become an addictive behavior with very serious results from those who suffer from such an addiction. Now, it's all very well in a sense to say that. We do need to know more about the facts of gambling addiction generally, its causes, its consequences, its cures, and of course we need to know that in the specific context of a developing country such as South Africa. So, if I may, I would draw your attention only to the last 6 points under research in my document. It's right at the end, so hopefully it won't take too long to go through. The first and surprising result we have found is that problem gambling does not increase. That is, the number of problem gamblers in South Africa in 2008 was pretty much the same as the number in 2001. You might think that that is a very surprising result. All I can tell you is that it is a result which has been repeated in jurisdictions varying from New Zealand and the United Kingdom to, most surprisingly, the United States, where particularly casino gambling has proliferated since roughly 1990. Now, actually, the number of problem gamblers in the United States is about the same in 1980 as it is in 2009. And that is a very surprising statistic. And it tells us something about the personality of the addicted gambler, and indeed the addicted cocaine user, the addicted heroin user, the addicted smoker, and so forth, in the same way that it does about the addicted gambler. When we come to consider different forms of gambling or different environments in which gambling takes place, some, again, surprising but interesting and politically important results emerge. First of all, contrary to what most people think, very little addictive gambling is associated with casinos. Now, you might think that's surprising because casinos are big and brash and have lots of high prize high stakes gambling machines in them. I suspect that the real reason is that casino gambling is very expensive. And just as very expensive products are only available to a relative minority of people who can afford them, so I suspect that you don't get much problem gambling associated with casinos because of the price. Now, looking at the big game lottery, we get an interesting finding in South Africa. First of all, the big game lottery is much safer than any other form of gambling because it is only participated in once or twice a week and it is comparatively cheap. However, of those who only play the lottery, our numbers in South Africa are 17 times higher than the same numbers in the United Kingdom. What this suggests to me is that gambling is essentially, or problem gambling, is essentially a form of addiction which involves the abuse of money. Now, it isn't that poor people are more feckless or more reckless or more prone to addiction than richer people. It's they've just got less money. And so you don't have to buy many lottery tickets before you're starting to have a serious negative impact on the economic well-being of your family. And this is true of the big game lottery, which is both geographically and financially more accessible to poor people than any other form of gambling. It's even truer of scratch cards, because scratch cards you can play again and again and again, and they are more like fruit machines in terms of repeated action. So that's what I would say about the big game lottery and the scratch cards. Frankly, racing and other sports betting, we just don't know enough about them. We don't know enough because there's not much of them. We don't know enough of the profiles of the players. The one thing I would warn is that this is going to become very big, very soon, on the internet. Here, as it has everywhere else in the world, particularly in Asia. So, you know, don't simply think that racing is harmless because it's harmless here. Think of racing and sports betting as being potentially harmless on the internet. Again, LPMs, we frankly don't know much about. There are very few of them. We have no particular reason on our demographic studies, and we've done studies on poverty, we have no reason to believe that where LPMs are available and located in poor areas, there's more trouble with problem gambling than there is in either areas where there's no LPMs or which are wealthier. So I'm agnostic on LPMs. Remote gambling via cell phones, the internet, and interactive gambling, I would say the following. It isn't a big problem at the moment. Worldwide, it's about 7% of all gambling. In South Africa, it's about 2%. And that's probably because so few people have access to the relevant technology. However, I would not be complacent. And I would not be complacent for two reasons. One is, it is certain to grow. And it's going to be very difficult to regulate once it has grown. I mean, some people think that internet gambling will be 50% of all gambling worldwide in 15 years. I'm not a gambling man, so I wouldn't make a prediction on that. But it's quite an alarming thought. And of course, South Africa will participate in that huge growth in internet gambling. The other thing I would worry about internet gambling is that it can be done increasingly on cell phones, and that is a problem for young people who constitute about 50% of the population. So my advice would be to think hard about that. Those things are in the future. If I were to have to say what you should worry about now, I would quote our latest research and I would say it's illegal gambling. It's mostly taking place in the townships, often associated with illegal drinking. And it's mostly engaged in by unemployed males under the age of 30. So, if you wanted to do one thing to abolish problem gambling, abolish unemployment. I'm not suggesting that that is within the remit of this committee to do, but there is a clear connection between having nothing to do, boredom, and playing illegal games like Fafi, dice, cards in townships, very often associated with Shabins. That's really all I can tell you about our research so far. It is striking that the growth of illegal gambling has been associated with something you might find surprising, namely the number of people who don't gamble at all. It used to be 70% of the population, it's now 50% of the population. 50% of the population. Why should that be? Answer, because, I mean, I'm speculating a bit here, but it's an informed speculation. Answer, because the lottery was suspended. When the lottery was suspended, quite a lot of people who used to play the lottery regularly didn't take it up again. But a few who were deprived of their gambling opportunities started playing illegal games in the townships. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor. Honourable members, do you have any questions, comments?
You must tell me what I must do with the technology.
I take it then you'll never be an interactive gambler. But we could just move on. Yes. Honourable Kamala, Honourable Vanderbeek-Tayson, and Honourable Kwabasa, I'm sorry.
Thanks, Honourable Jefferson. No, I just want to have, or before maybe I can get a clarity, I just want to make a comment to say, I disagree with the professor when he says when we need to abolish the gambling, we have to abolish the unemployment. Simply because
sorry,
when
we need to upgrade.
To abolish the unemployment, if I heard you correctly. Simply because, Chairperson, if you go there, for an example, to casinos, you get there, you see what type of cars are there being driven by people that are fully employed, that are there to gamble. You go there, an employed female who knock off at 5 o'clock and go straight to casino, very employed, trying to increase the money, not solely because that particular person is unemployed, but because to me, there is this addiction that is there, that has to be removed. That is one thing I disagree with the comment that he made. Secondly, the clarity that I want to make is that to people that are always there 24 hours, I mean being there up until they're using all their money, don't even have a cent to go back home, is there any a form of assisting them in order to draw the line as to where they have to, stop when they have to get to this, addiction of being, of gambling. But where, how can they be assisted in order to draw the line to say, I have to use this amount of money, but when I'm getting there, I have to stop. That is what the clarification that I want to get. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kamado. Honourable Van der Westhuizen.
Chairperson, thank you. Thank you to the professor. He has certainly helped us with some myths in terms of the gambling world. I just want to ask from you the education regarding gambling. Can you perhaps expand on that? And secondly, you know, the warnings that are being put up at gambling places. A slogan like "Winners know when to stop." Does that really, you know, do people understand it? I would think something like, you know, the worst investment you can do with your winnings is to keep on playing would be, you know, more of a shocker, or would start people thinking. If you could comment on the effectiveness of those warnings, please.
Thank you. Honourable Kobalza.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. Quite an interesting observation made by the professor on this thing. I just wanted to ask if in the course of your research, have you identified any form of manipulation of this machine?
Sorry?
Have you identified any form of manipulation of the machines to which then results in predetermined winnings? That's the first thing. The second thing that I would like you to comment on, if possible. Some time back, I had I was fortunate to attend a monetary policy forum convened by the outgoing governor some years back. And in the course of the discussion, he commented that all these forms of gambling, including lottery, were causing a problem of uncontrollable rise of inflation, because people are, especially the poor, who are in the majority, are taking money that should go into the basket of grocery. They're taking it away into gambling, and thereby enriching fewer people, and it's money that cannot be accounted as part of, for instance, the CPI, as part of the basket of grocery per family. And you are saying that it's causing a huge economic problem, particularly in terms of inflation. Can you comment on that? Thanks.
Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I appreciate the research which was done by Professor, in particular when making comparisons with the issues of what's happening in the United Kingdom, America, whatever. But what I like also is the problem statement he raised, the issue of internet gambling. How do the other countries control that? Because right now, as you know, I was looking at this magazine, Indwe, in the South African Express. You find that there are huge lotteries there of about 2.9 billion rand, something of that nature. So people will be tempted to even go abroad, although it's so difficult to win a lottery. But because of those monies involved, they'll be tempted to bet even abroad. So it means that we'll be losing a lot of money outside the country. So what are the other countries doing around that problem?
Thank you. Honourable Marek.
Thank you, Chair. Professor, the I don't know if you have had any findings or a correlation that you found between the advertisements of interactive gambling and the incidence of people participating in that. Just to see whether that has got any serious effect or not, or whether that's a danger or what. Thank you.
Thank you. And from myself, Professor, how does one determine a problem gambler who claims to be an occasional gambler? What sort of measure, what sort of criterion determines problem gambling? Well, Professor, look as concisely and expeditiously as possible in whichever order.
Let me try and take them in the order they were posed. I confess, being a little flippant when I said that unemployment would be the best cure for problem gambling. Obviously, unemployment in South Africa would be the best cure for almost all social problems. And I meant to say curing unemployment. That is employment. The point I was making simply is that there is a connection between young people, youngish people, who have nothing to do and are not deterred by the fact that gambling is illegal. So I was identifying, if you like, the typical problem gambler who is probably gambling now illegally. On the question of the internet and the casinos and 24 hours, I would urge your committee to bear in mind that when we had this debate in the United Kingdom, people said, if we have the sorts of casinos we have in South Africa, people will gamble all day and all night, and it will lead to terrible social problems. Now, the money, and as a result, those casinos were banned. Now, as a result, the money that would have been spent in those casinos is now being spent 24 hours a day on unregulated offline casinos located in Gibraltar or Antigua or wherever. So don't think that by banning or restricting the spending or the time available to spend money on one form of gambling, you are going to stop the amount of gambling that is spent on other forms of gambling, particularly now that we have the internet. So I think anyone can gamble for any amount they like, even as we speak, 24 hours a day, and short of introducing very draconian measures, you can't stop them. And they can do it on the internet. So, you know, close down a casino and people will gamble on a casino on the internet. That would be my answer to that question. The effectiveness of education, I'm inclined to think that the most honest answer to that is we know for certain that 50% of advertising works. The trouble is we don't know which 50%. And I don't actually know whether saying on gambling straplines, winners know when to stop, makes any difference at all. One thing I do know, though, is that if we are not getting the advertising, I mean, we're not getting the gambling companies to pay for that advertising, the state's going to have to pay for it, or something like it. And I'd rather that the gambling companies paid for it than that I did myself. So I hope that's a fair and honest answer to your question. As far as the manipulation of machines is concerned, I can say categorically, no legal machine in this country is manipulated, not even to the point of having near misses, partly because we've checked that, and partly because, more substantially, any machine, any company caught manipulating machines would lose its license, and it could not afford to do so. Where you do get manipulation of machines is on the internet, where, for example, you can play for play. That is, no money changes hands. And if you go onto an internet site and do this, you will find that in next to no time, you're $10,000 up. You then switch to playing for pay, and you will find that in next to no time you are $10,000 down. So manipulation does go on, but it doesn't go on in casinos, LPMs, etc., because they've got too much to lose. So that would be my answer to that question. I can't now read my... Oh, uncontrollable. Uncontrollable. Can anyone who... ask a question about...
Self-fundable for Rallo, but possibility of... Is there any way of stopping gambling? Or addressing? Who addressed?
One of the... Yes, okay.
Barca.
Please explain to me if I'm not answering the right question. But I think the question was about how do you stop people who can't control their gambling so that they can become people who can control their gambling. Now, what we know about that is that there's a small minority, it's about 0.3% of the adult population in the UK, it's well under 1% in South Africa, who clearly have an addiction problem, and they almost certainly have a lot of other addiction problems too. They're likely to smoke, they're likely to drink, they're likely to do drugs, they're likely to compulsively shop, and so on. So there's a small population that, if you like, the best thing to do with them is to ban them or give them a pill, which may be coming. But anyway, the best thing is just to keep them out of casinos, betting shops, lottery tickets, because they can't control themselves. A much larger number of people can control themselves, and they are people, it's about 5% of the adult population, they are people who don't, in all important senses, know what they're doing. And they can be taught how to control themselves by, for example, being taught that when red has come up six times on the roulette wheel, it's just as likely to come up red and just as likely to come up black the next time. And so there are things like that which people can be educated about. They can be taught that there is no such person as Lady Luck. They can be taught that actually, no, it is not true that casino executives at 3 o'clock in the morning sneak round their casinos and set some machines to pay out big time the next day. So there are all sorts of superstitions that can be dissipated. They can also, more positively, be taught that just as they would budget if they went out for a meal or went clothes shopping, they should budget for their gambling. So they say, right, I'm going to take 150 rand to the casino tonight, and when it's gone, I'm stopping. And that's what people do with most forms of consumption. As I say, I'm a little embarrassed because I'm not sure that was the question I was asked. It certainly relates to the question you asked about internet control, and there's some very interesting work going on here. It is true that internet is potentially the most dangerous form of gambling because you can gamble as much as you like, whenever you like, and without even getting out of bed. On the other hand, we are not finding that internet gamblers are more seriously getting into trouble than offline gamblers. What we are finding is that students are getting into trouble because they spend so much time doing it. So that's a problem. But as for controlling it, one of the things you can do on the internet is use technology to tame technology. And you can, in fact, track back people's actual play and see who's likely and who's not likely to get into trouble. And you can then intervene. So there are answers to that.
Are we concluding now?
Yes, I just thought I ought to answer the advertisement question.
You have?
Oh, sorry?
No.
Well, my own view, for what it's worth, is that advertising of internet doesn't make much difference unless everybody else is advertising on the internet. In other words, if no one is allowed to advertise on the internet, companies would save their advertising budgets. And, oh yes, just lastly, there certainly is a very, very important difference between problem gamblers and recreational gamblers. 95 at least of recreational gamblers never have any trouble at all. They score naught on all the screens. So for the vast majority of people, gambling is indeed a harmless form of recreation. Obviously, we've got to do what we can about the problem gamblers, but, you know, we've also got to respect the rights of those who enjoy gambling harmlessly. I'm sorry to have taken up so much of your time.
I just wanted to, that was a little anecdotal, so I just wanted to get the score. You know, you, in your documentation, you actually refer to a score of seven.
Two.
Seven. You know, you use your scores, or whoever did the research used the score. Seven. That's number seven.
Oh, yes.
Yes, right. And that the seven was the problem gamblers. Now, what constitutes seven? How, you know, what is it, the criteria? What is it that is equal seven? Obviously, not one, two, three, and four, but a five. But I mean, exactly what's equal seven?
Yeah. This is a major problem with all screens, and indeed with all screens, with all psychological tests. Seven is the Gamblers Anonymous standard number. They say, if you score seven affirmatives, you probably got a problem. Now, the sort of questions are, do you chase losses? Do you quarrel with your spouse or your partner about gambling? Do you sometimes find that you can't pay the rent at the end of the month, and so on? If you score 7 out of 20, which is, you know, just over a third, then you should seek help.
If I understand correctly, it's a qualitative, subjective score. You're asking someone to respond to something.
Well, the only way you can do that is by engaging in the very expensive process of fMRI scanning. And there are ways of doing that. They don't necessarily predict for problem gambling, but they do predict for gambling generally.
No, Professor Collins, I certainly wish we'd had more time, but you have left your studies, you know, the research with us. And perhaps we may wish to just engage you outside the meeting, perhaps in an email and so on, and perhaps you would then be able to respond to any outstanding queries we may have. And we will do that through the committee secretary. And you will indicate to the committee secretary when that response would be required by, we would require the response by. Thank you very much, Professor,
thank
for
you
your time. Honourable members, we all have very busy schedules and so on, and a lot of documentation stuff. So at this particular point in time, I would like us to just be reminded that there is our next meeting, as I understand, is on Friday, when we will be here at 8:30, and we will try to apply our minds quite expeditiously to the DTI input on the annual report and the engagement with the minister himself in that regard. And, of course, the department as well. So there is an appeal to all members. I know that there are certain problems and so on, but there is an appeal that this is our portfolio. Let us try and be there if we can. And thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.